The first section of today's episode deals with issues of rape and sexual violence in conflict situations. You may wish to skip ahead to the second section, which begins at 17 minutes.
The larger the cultural distance between the ethnic groups involved in conflict, the more likely is sexual violence to occur.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. What inspires conflict? What determines how a war is fought and who chooses to fight it? Eleonora Guarnieri of the University of Exeter has done research into the role of cultural differences in war that is both fascinating and disturbing, as you'll find out. And she joins me now. Eleonora, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Hello, Tim. Thanks so much for having me.
Which conflicts are we going to be talking about today? Which ones have you investigated in your research? How much do we know about these conflicts?
My research so far has focused on ethnic civil conflicts. These are interstate conflicts where one or more armed groups fight against the central government. And these armed groups pursue ethnic interests and recruit fighters based on ethnic affiliation. Now, since the end of World War II, civil conflicts have been by far the most common form of war that have been fought all around the world. And sadly, it's also been the deadliest. The death toll coming from civil conflicts have been 5 times as large as the death toll coming from international conflicts, meaning conflict between countries. And more than half of all the nations in the world have experienced civil conflicts in the past half century. These conflicts are extremely costly. Besides the immediate death toll from them, they also come with disastrous consequences that are both physical and psychological and that affect entire communities and are passed down through the generations. And while there is a very large interdisciplinary literature studying the economic, institutional, and also cultural determinants of conflict, I think there is still a lot we need to learn to understand why conflicts happen, who fights and why, and also about the types of violence that actors choose to employ when fighting.
We're going to be looking at 2 pieces of research you've done today. The first one, which is a paper you co-authored with Anatol Prats, you analysed acts of sexual violence in armed conflicts. What types of sexual violence? How pervasive? How common are they in war?
Sexual violence in armed conflict, it's a brutal and pervasive form of wartime violence. It's predominantly inflicted against women and girls. It can actually take many forms. While rape is the most common one, it can also manifest in other ways through sexual slavery, sexual mutilation and torture, forced pregnancy and forced abortion. Rape alone was present in 62% of civil wars around the world that have been fought between 1989 and 2009. During the well-known, sadly, Rwandan genocide, in only 4 months, it's estimated that at least 500,000 women were raped. During the Bosnian War, 50,000 women were raped. And in just one single day, the Myanmar army raped over 100 women during a military operation against the Rohingya. So as you can see, sexual violence can happen in conflicts that take place anywhere in the world and not just in one specific region. And its incidence can be really dramatic. Despite this, what Anna and I were surprised to see in the data is that the prevalence and intensity of sexual violence actually can vary considerably across conflicts, but also across actors within the same conflicts and even within the same actors. So you see some armed groups perpetrating sexual violence against certain populations and opponents, but not others.
Where do you find this data on sexual violence?
So the data comes from some great work that has been done by 2 very prominent scholars in political science, Cohen and Nordes, and their team. They put together the so-called sexual violence in armed conflict, or SVAC, dataset for every armed actor involved in a conflict since 1989. By actors, I mean rebel forces and government forces. Mm-hmm. SVAC draws on annual reports from three sources: Human Rights Watch, the US State Department, and Amnesty International. And they measure the extent to which each actor perpetrates sexual violence in a given year or not. Basically, SVAC gives us an index of intensity of sexual violence that ranges between 0 and 3, with 0 denoting no sexual violence used, and 3 denoting massive and systematic use of sexual violence.
Now, you're investigating how the difference in ideas, notions of gender equality between the perpetrators and the victims are relevant. What dimensions of gender equality do you consider here? And how do you get from those ideas, those dimensions, to be able to attribute values to each side in a conflict?
So measuring the degree of gender equality, or at the other extreme, male dominance of mm-hmm. perpetrators and victims of sexual violence, it's not an easy task. So before we move to this, I want to specify that in our work, Anna and I talk about victims of sexual violence, but we acknowledge that some victims may prefer to be called survivors.
Right.
So allow me the use of victims throughout our chat, but remembering this important point.
Mm-hmm.
Now back to gender norms. How do we measure them? Anna and I rely on anthropological work, and this work is very fascinating and has uncovered that basically societal norms about gender, so those prescriptions of what is the appropriate role of men and women in society, these norms can be traced back to ancestral conditions, meaning pre-industrial conditions, that relate to family arrangements and economic activities. For instance, higher gender equality tends to be found in societies in which family arrangements revolve more around women, for example, matrilineal groups, or where women contributed significantly to economic subsistence, for example, in societies relying more on gathering or shifting agriculture for subsistence. And at the other extreme, obviously, we have more male-dominant norms that can be found in, for instance, pastoralist societies or societies relying on plow agriculture, mm-hmm. where the role of men instead in subsistence is more pronounced. And what Anna and I do, after consulting this literature, we grouped 10 key ancestral characteristics into a single index that we call Male Dominance Index, and find that this index is very highly correlated with contemporary measures of gender inequality, like female employment, some preference, or attitudes towards white beating. And then we assign this index to perpetrators and victims of sexual violence in ethnic civil conflicts.
And you're sure that these norms that you document, they are part of the ethnic identity rather than an economic status or education?
Good point. Our choice to measure gender norms at the ethnicity level, so having an ethnic group as unit of observation,
mm-hmm.
it's obviously motivated by the fact that the actors involved in the conflicts we study are characterized by a specific ethnic identity. Ethnicity can be thought of as groups of individuals that come together and experience a sense of commonality that can be based on a belief in common ancestry or common culture. And because our index focuses on ancestral characteristics, it does capture these deep-rooted gender norms and is therefore unaffected by contemporary economic development or institutions. Now, of course, you're absolutely right that gender norms can change over time, and this change may well go hand in hand with economic development or the level of education, etc. There are other indices out there, such as the Gender Inequality Index constructed by the United Nations Development Programme,
mm-hmm.
which is built at the country level. It's time varying and is indeed very much correlated with countries' GDP per capita, for instance. But what's interesting is that what we see is that the deep-rooted factors that Anna and I measure are still very, very powerful in predicting variation in gender norms across different ethnic groups within the same country, meaning within the same institutional and economic setting. So this, in a way, really tells us that deep-rooted factors still play very much a role in shaping beliefs about gender today. And also, this speaks really in favor of using ethnicity-specific indices as opposed to country-wide measures to measure cultural norms and not just gender norms, especially if the focus is really very ethnically diverse regions in the world.
So you have this data on gender norms, and you have this data on the use of sexual violence in conflict. What are you trying to test here? What are you trying to discover?
There are two questions. The first one is, why do some armed groups use sexual violence while others do not?
Mm-hmm.
And here the hypothesis is that sexual violence in conflict will be more prevalent among more male-dominant actors. The second question is, why is it that we observe the same actor using sexual violence against certain opponents, against certain populations, but not others?
Mm-hmm.
And here we hypothesize that an actor's cultural distance in gender norms to their opponent will increase their use of sexual violence.
What relationships do you find?
We find that more male-dominant actors are more likely to perpetrate sexual violence in conflict. And this finding, by the way, is very much in line with previous literature that uncovered a link between gender norms and intimate partner violence. But this link had never been established in the context of wartime gender-based violence. The larger the cultural distance between the ethnic groups involved in conflict, the more likely is sexual violence to occur. This is really driven by one specific cultural clash. Sexual violence increases only when the perpetrator is more male dominant than the victim, but not vice versa.
Can we possibly work out what the motivation is here? Why people will act in this way?
This is a very important question, and we spent a lot of time trying to understand why this relationship is there. To understand perpetrators' use of sexual violence, we read a lot of this amazing interdisciplinary literature on sexual violence in war. This literature has identified two broad motivations for the use of sexual violence. One is strategic and the other one is expressive. So let me explain what this means.
Mm-hmm.
So the strategic use of sexual violence matches this common perception you may have heard of rape as a weapon of war and involves basically commanders authorizing it or mandating it to achieve their military goals, meaning eventually winning the war.
Yeah.
There is also an expressive use of sexual violence, which arises from combatants' private motivations, such as desire for power, sexual gratification, or to release frustration. And what we argue is that cultural distance in gender norms influences both the decision to use sexual violence for strategic motivation as well as for expressive motivations. For the strategic use of sexual violence, think about a commander's decision. A commander has to decide whether to mandate sexual violence or not. And you can think about a cost-benefit framework. So on the one hand, the costs of exerting mandating sexual violence, which include the legal and social punishment, as well as the emotional toll of inflicting such an intimate and also violent act, the costs will be lower among male-dominant actors with more permissive laws and social norms on violence against women. But on the other hand, sexual violence used as a weapon of war can be way more effective if used against more gender-equal societies, more gender-equal opponents, where women have a more productive role in society and in the economy. The result of this is that male-dominant perpetrators facing opponents who are more gender equal will resort to sexual violence for strategic purposes. But then, while war and sexual violence can serve military goal, it can also be used expressively by soldiers as a reaction to a feeling of grievance. You can think about a soldier who confronts a more gender equal society in the conflict. And if you're a soldier with very pronounced male dominant roles, you may feel, you may perceive that the relatively better position of women in the opponent's society constitutes a threat to your norms, to your own ideals, and you may use sexual violence as a tool to alleviate these negative feelings.
It's almost impossible to think about the idea of policy. These acts are so transgressive. Is there anything that you think we can do, that policymakers can do, to lessen this systematic use of rape as a weapon of war?
As hard as it is to think about it, I think this is an extremely important question.
Yes.
That actually deserves a lot of more future research, especially on what interventions and policies may work to, on the one hand, prevent sexual violence in war, but also what could work to support the survivors of sexual violence, their families, and their communities. There is still a lot we need to learn, but what I can tell you, based on our findings, is that we really need to pay special attention to the status of women in the context of conflict in general, but even more when these conflicts are fought by male-dominant actors, especially if there is a marked difference in gender norms between combatants and between perpetrators and victims of sexual violence.
Eleonora, we're going to look at some more recent research that you've done on cultural distance and how it relates to ethnic civil conflict, particularly in Africa. I think I'm right in saying Africa has large numbers of ethnically diverse countries. Why is that?
Yes, the African continent is one of the most diverse places on Earth. The degree of ethnic diversity within today's African countries is remarkable. So there is a historical explanation for this. During the so-called Scramble for Africa, this took place between the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, Europeans partitioned Africa into colonies, protectorates, and colonial powers drew their borders in Europe without any consideration whatsoever of pre-existing geographical, institutional, and cultural conditions. What this means is that many different ethnic groups happen to coexist within the same colonial jurisdiction. These artificially constructed countries keep on existing today in the post-colonial era. Contemporary African countries are still very, very ethnically and culturally diverse.
And are these ethnically diverse countries more likely to suffer civil conflict?
Yes. There is a very influential literature that has examined both theoretically and also empirically the relationship between a country's level of ethnic diversity and the emergence of civil conflict. And overall, this literature has shown that countries that exhibit higher levels of ethnic diversity, measured either via ethnic polarization indices or ethnic fractionalization indices, these countries are more likely to experience civil conflict. But what this literature on diversity and conflict has not yet studied is why is it that some groups within the same country engage in conflict while others do not? And why is it that groups decide to rebel and fight at specific points in time and not at other times?
It's a fascinating question, but to investigate that, you need some fairly detailed information about what is happening in these civil conflicts. Where do you find that?
My dataset is at the ethnic group level. I follow each African ethnic group over time, and I track their involvement in civil conflict against the central government.
Mm-hmm.
So data on conflict comes from a really good data set that has been widely used in the conflict literature. It comes from the Uppsala Conflict Data Program, UCDP. This data is very rich and provides information on all the actors involved in civil conflict, what these actors are fighting over, whether government power or territory and resources, and also whether conflict is fought along ethnic lines or not.
So many interesting questions. In this case, what are you looking for?
My dataset at the ethnicity level is useful because it allows me to explore how ethnic groups' cultural distance to the ethnicities forming the central government affects their decision to rebel. Now, building on existing theories of conflict, my hypothesis is that an increase in cultural distance should increase an ethnicity's propensity to fight over government power.
Mm-hmm.
You can imagine that by construction, every group in a country is subjected to the public policies, the public goods that the government provides, whether one likes them or not. Cultural distance between groups can generate diverging preferences on what is the ideal type of public good to be provided, or how should we allocate public services and resources. If there are differences in preferences over public goods between an ethnic group and the government, this will give rise to disagreement and ultimately lead to conflict.
But again, how do you measure cultural distance?
It's definitely not an easy task because one needs to find a measure that successfully captures all these values, preferences, and tastes that constitute culture. I use a widely used measure in the literature, which is linguistic distance. So the use of linguistic distance is motivated by the notion that language is a very salient dimension of culture, and it's also one that is transmitted almost unchanged down through the generations. Different languages, as we know them today, are the result of horizontal separations between populations, and these separations may have gone hand in hand with cultural divergence.
But very different cultures live side by side peacefully most of the time. Conflict isn't happening everywhere all of the time. So what events are you looking for here that create this higher potential for conflict? What's the spark here? What's the event?
The prevalence of conflict will increase in response to an increase in cultural distance to the government.
Mm-hmm.
So consequently, in my empirical analysis, the source of variation I exploit is induced by changes in the ethnic identity of the government, meaning power transitions between ethnic groups over time. So these power transitions are therefore the event of interest because they generate within ethnicity variation in cultural distance, which is what the source of variation I exploit in my estimation strategy.
And what do you find? What is this relationship between cultural distance and the likelihood of conflict?
After a power transition, the prevalence of conflict over power increases, but only among ethnic groups that become culturally more distant from the government. But it does not happen for groups who become culturally closer or whose cultural distance remains unchanged.
This is, again, a cultural distance. It's not an economic distance.
Precisely. I do consider alternative explanations. For example, what you mentioned here is an important one. Cultural differences may be correlated with income differences between groups. And if this was the case systematically, well, then my results could be picking up the effect of economic grievances, for instance. And there is literature, there are papers who have shown that economic grievances are indeed linked to conflict in my setting. I do find that income differences are associated with conflict, but the effect of linguistic distance on conflict occurs over and above and independently of the effect of income differences.
Is it possible to find out what the rebels in this case want? Are they looking for power, or are they just looking for, well, better treatment, more consideration by the government?
empirically, it's very hard to say. So
yes,
the type of conflicts I'm studying are in these those that are fought over government power or to change the composition of the government. But this is a very general categorization. And unfortunately, I do not have nuanced data on what rebels really want. And I can therefore not make conclusive statements here. But I do have some additional results that may help us a little bit understand what's behind the effects I uncover. In my analysis, changes in cultural distance to the government can also be induced by ethnic groups entering or exiting power. An increasing cultural distance, therefore, can coincide with an ethnicity losing government power. And you can imagine that this could trigger conflict, not much because of cultural considerations, but due to the desire to regain the power position that the group has just lost. Is the effect of cultural distance entirely explained by ethnic groups being removed from power and therefore wanting to regain the just lost power position? I find that being removed from power makes an ethnic group more likely to rebel. Mm-hmm. But again, there remains a very large and significant independent effect of cultural distance that cannot be explained by the desire to regain a just lost power position. And this is, again, consistent with the cultural explanation I propose for my findings, whereby conflict emerges because groups dislike the mix of public goods and policies implemented by a culturally distant government, mm-hmm. kind of no matter whether they are represented in the government coalition or not. And indeed, then when I look at survey data, I find that respondents are much more likely to be dissatisfied with a government when they are more culturally distant from it. And even more generally, no matter who is in power at a given point in time, I also find that linguistically, culturally distant groups are much more likely to differ in their views about what the government should do, what type of public goods and policies should be provided, which again is very consistent with the cultural explanation I put forward.
And we arrive back at policy again. You can't easily change cultural distance between groups. It's not legitimate to tell different groups to be more like each other. Can a government, can a policymaker, I suppose, do anything to make civil conflict less likely based on your analysis?
Again, a very difficult one to answer. Some of my findings may help us, I think, take a step in this direction. For instance, when thinking about Africa specifically, which is the regional focus of my study, something that often comes to mind is ethnic favoritism. Ethnic favoritism is very common in Africa. It has been widely documented. We know that leaders tend to favor members of their own group when they allocate public resources. Is the effect of cultural distance on conflict more pronounced when there is ethnic favoritism? And the answer is yes, it is the case. Ethnic groups are significantly more likely to react to cultural distance to the government by engaging in conflict whenever the government provides more particularistic goods as opposed to more public goods that everyone in principle could enjoy, or where public resources are unequally distributed across groups within a country. So what this finding suggests is that investing in public resources that generate more public goods and ensuring that these public goods and services are equally distributed across social groups, these are first very important steps that governments can take to attenuate, alleviate the effect of cultural distance on conflict.
Leonora, thank you.
Thanks, Tim.
the papers we've been talking about. The first one is Cultural Distance and Conflict-Related Sexual Violence, and the authors, Eleonora Guarnieri and Anatole Prats. That was published in the QJE in 2023. Also from 2023, Eleonora's paper, Cultural Distance and Ethnic Civil Conflict. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. And our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where you will also find articles about the topics we feature.